currently at King's College. He actually got his PhD some time ago. After that, he...
My PhD is a different King's College.
Oh.
Not King's College London, got my PhD in King's College Cambridge.
I avoided the subject carefully enough. After that, I went to Sri Lanka. Yes?
Yes.
And then was at CERN for many, many years. And now we went back to King's College. So he already gave a seminar yesterday, which was very well attended. And today he's giving a colloquium in this very good site.
Okay, well,
is this working?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, well, anyway, thanks very much for the invitation to come back to Perimeter. I remember some years ago, Lee organized a very nice little meeting here, which I had pleasure in attending. Anyway, where is particle physics going? So, of course, I have no idea. I don't have any better ideas than anybody else. But in this talk, I want to at least discuss some of the issues that we in particle physics have to grapple with at the present time, and some of the solutions that are being suggested in terms of future accelerators for maybe probing possible new physics beyond the standard model. Now, when I show this slide, I often quiz the audience whether anybody knows where this picture might have been taken. This time I'll give you a hint. There's at least one person in the audience who should know. Okay, anyway, here in the background, you see a few peaks, you know, off in the misty distance. And of course, a few years ago, one of those peaks might have represented the Higgs boson, which was discovered in 2012. So here's a picture of Peter Higgs actually shortly after he made his proposal. This is in 1965, and he's working out some of the details of his theory here, so you can steal them if you can read what's written there. Anyway, of course, the big question that we're all confronting in particle physics is there life after Higgs? We firmly expect that there is some sort of physics beyond the standard model, but which of these ideas on the horizon is real and which one of them is a mirage remains, I think, not at all obvious at the present time. So we don't know where we're going. How do we achieve our goal of discovering this new physics beyond the standard model? So I'm going to be focusing on accelerator-based experiments, although I will say a few words about dark matter and cosmology. So I know everybody has their favorite Beatle. Mine is possibly George Harrison. And he has a song where the refrain is, "If you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there." I'm not sure that I completely agree with him. So I prefer to paraphrase him and say, "Any road may take you there." Okay, so our search for physics beyond the standard model is, of course, based on our understanding, our quantitative understanding of the physics within the standard model. So a large component of that is provided by QCD. This is, after all, the dominant physics at the LHC and other possible future colliders. Another element in our understanding is, of course, the electroweak theory, which has been tested very precisely in many experiments dating back over decades. And as I will discuss later in this talk, electroweak measurements are an important ingredient in our search for physics beyond the standard model. Then, of course, there's the flavor sector, which is an active area of research, also so far highly consistent with the standard model, although there are various anomalies that people talk about, and I'll discuss them very briefly in my talk. So the Higgs occupies pride of place in this possible route towards physics beyond the standard model. And I will discuss various ways in which one can probe the Higgs boson in a search for possible physics beyond the standard model. So one technique which is being discussed a lot these days is the standard model effective field theory. And this is something I like particularly because it's a way of integrating our probes of new physics in the electroweak sector and also in the Higgs sector. I'm not going to say so much about neutrino physics. Many of you would say, well, look, neutrino physics has already revealed physics beyond the standard model by virtue of oscillations. That's obviously true, but the relationship of that neutrino physics to the other parts of physics that I've got on this slide is not so obvious, and I'm not going to be spending so much time discussing it. So obviously, astrophysics and cosmology provide us with important constraints, perhaps also clues about what physics might lie beyond the standard model. And I'm going to be discussing a couple of aspects of that in this talk. One is dark matter, and the other one is the future of the universe. And in the final part of this talk, I will be discussing various ideas for possible new accelerators, including also the planned high luminosity upgrade of the LHC, but also various other possible future colliders of protons and electrons and positrons. Okay, so as I commented earlier, the basis for our searches for new physics, at least at the LHC, is QCD, which enables us to calculate all these various different standard model cross sections. And this, of course, is a major industry. And I'm afraid I don't have enough time here to give justice to the effort that has gone into making all these theoretical calculations, which are then compared successfully with many experimental measurements, including now many measurements in the Higgs sector. Various different Higgs production modes, various different Higgs decay modes, kinematics of Higgs production, and so on. So far, everything seems to be in depressingly good agreement with the standard model. As for the flavor sector, there is this standard poster child, I would call it a rainbow plot of the flavor observables, where various different measurements in B physics and K physics and so on and so forth converge to give you this unitarity triangle. The fact that this triangle has a non-zero area is a measure of the amount of CP violation in the strong interaction. So there's ongoing measurements of various parameters of this triangle. For example, the LHCb experiment at CERN has recently come up with the most precise measurement of this angle down here. Now, flavor physics actually contains a bunch of observables that seem to be in tension at some level with standard model predictions. And this is a sort of listing of them, which is ranked according to somebody's assessment of their significance. I'm not sure whether this really makes a lot of sense. I think a lot of these measurements, the interpretation is bedeviled by systematic uncertainties, not so much statistical uncertainties. Anyway, I personally tend to rank them according to green, yellow, and red, depending on how seriously I take them as possible evidence for physics beyond the standard model. So one of them has to do with possible violation of lepton universality in B decays into K L plus L minus. This, for me, is a wait and see. I think that the statistics here are not totally convincing. Then there's an old thing which has been hanging around, measurements of the Fermilab Tevatron of a possible CP violating asymmetry. This has not been confirmed by parallel measurements of the LHC, so that one I don't worry about. An interesting one is possible evidence, again, for lepton flavor violation, this time in B decays into taus. And there's a fair amount of excitement about that in certain quarters at the moment. Again, I think that maybe systematic uncertainties dominate over statistical uncertainties. So again, that gets a yellow wait and see. B decays again into this time into the muons, the particular angular distribution being claimed. There's a discrepancy there with the standard model. I think here certainly the standard model uncertainties have been underestimated. I think perhaps the anomaly which I would like to recommend to people's attention is, well, it's not actually, I don't know whether you really called it a flavor anomaly. This is the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon, G minus 2. So those of you with long memories will recall that about 15 years ago now, a Brookhaven experiment reported a discrepancy with standard model calculations. There haven't been so many new experimental results in the intervening period. There's been a lot of effort, theoretically, to try to refine the standard model calculation, and there still is a 3 or 4 standard deviation discrepancy. And the good news is that at least one new experiment at Fermilab is planned to remeasure G minus 2. And I, for one, would like to believe that this might be a harbinger of new physics. And if it is, it would have to be new physics at the TV scale or below. OK, let me move on now to Higgs physics. So what do we know about the Higgs? Well, we know its mass. In fact, we know its mass rather accurately. Its mass is now known with a precision of something like 2 per mil, a combination of measurements by Atlas and CMS. And in the coming years, it will be known even better, because currently the dominant uncertainty here is statistical. And certainly with round 2 of the LHC, we'll get more data, and the uncertainty will go down. So the interest in measuring this mass precisely is, of course, on the one hand, it enables you to do precision tests of the standard model by measuring very carefully branching ratios of decays of the Higgs boson, also production rates of the Higgs boson. But also, as we will see in a moment, the mass of the Higgs boson bears directly on the crucial issue of the stability of the electroweak vacuum and the future of the universe, which I advertised a little bit earlier on and which I'll return to in a moment. OK, so that's the mass. So how about the decays of the Higgs boson? So this Pitzer chart shows what we expect the Higgs boson to decay into. The dominant decay should be into bottom quarks. Interestingly, this is one decay of the Higgs boson that has not yet been established. There's many other smaller decay modes of the Higgs boson that have been established, but this decay, this dominant decay into BB bar, has not yet been established. So this is a compilation of measurements by the Atlas and CMS collaborations of their measurements of the Higgs boson in various different production and decay channels at the LHC. As I mentioned, although many modes have been detected, measured, the dominant expected decay into BB bar has not yet been established at the 5 sigma level that we like to talk about. And of course, there are many other decays of the Higgs boson which are out there still to be discovered. Let me mention, for example, the Higgs into mu plus mu minus. This is interesting because it's a decay into a second generation particle. That would be perhaps the first decay into a second generation particle that we may hope to see. It would also be nice to measure the coupling of the Higgs to the top quark. We have indirect information about that coming from production of the Higgs via glue-glue collisions and decays of the Higgs into gamma-gamma. We would like to measure directly the Higgs top coupling through associated production of the Higgs together with top quarks. OK, so a few years ago, with my then student, Tivong Yu, we tried to gather all this information together. And we asked ourselves the question, does the Higgs couple to other particles proportional to their mass? Since the Higgs field gives masses to other particles in the standard model, the couplings should be linearly dependent on the masses of other particles. So we looked at a parameterization where it wasn't a linear dependence on the mass, but a power 1 plus epsilon. And we put together the data to see what they were telling us. What they're telling us is the dashed line here with the dotted line, that's the one standard deviation uncertainties. And the red line, that is the standard model prediction. So the data from 1-1 certainly seem to indicate that this particle couples to other particles proportional to their mass. It looks like a kosher Higgs boson. Actually, in our paper, we wrote that this particle walks and quacks like a Higgs boson. Anyway, this type of analysis has subsequently been redone with a full run one data set with great care by the Atlas and CMS collaborations. And indeed, as you see here, everything is highly consistent with this linear dependence of Higgs couplings on particle mass. Now, one property of the Higgs boson in the standard model is that it should couple to fermions diagonally. So it couples to mu mu or to tau tau, but not to mu tau, for example. And one could ask, is the standard model right in that prediction? So there are upper limits on possible flavor-violating couplings of the Higgs boson from flavor-changing neutral interactions and other low-energy phenomena. And those, I think, pretty much rule out the possibility that you might see flavor, quark flavor-violating decays of the Higgs. But they don't rule out the possibility of lepton flavor-violating decays of the Higgs boson, which could occur at the level of 10% or so, consistent with other low-energy data. So the Atlas and CMS experiments set out to look, in particular, for the decay Higgs into tau mu. And rather to everybody's surprise, they seemed to find a non-zero effect at a level which would be consistent with the constraints that we and others had derived. Of course, this isn't significant, right? This is the level of a couple of standard deviations. And as I said, for a discovery of this type, you would insist on at least 5 standard deviations. Anyway, that was a sort of intriguing result from run 1 of the LHC. Unfortunately, preliminary data from run 2 of the LHC gives you an effect where actually the signal seems to be completely drowned in background. So at the moment, I think there's absolutely no significant evidence for any significant lepton flavor violating decay of the Higgs boson. But still, this is something that should be watched in the future. OK, so we've got a particle that seems to couple in a way reminiscent of the standard model Higgs boson. But is this an elementary particle or is it a composite particle? So here I think there are 2 schools of theoretical thought. So on the left here, we have the elementary people. And of course, they are worried about the quantum corrections that arise when you try to calculate loop corrections to the mass of the Higgs boson. And the favored option is to cut off those horrible quadratic divergences with some new physics at the TEV scale, such as supersymmetry. So that's the left alternative. Then on the right-hand side here, we have possibility that the Higgs is actually composite, made up out of some sort of elementary fermions, which are held together by some sort of new, strongly interacting dynamics, a little bit reminiscent of the pion in QCD or Cooper pairs in superconductivity. So various approaches to this have been tried in the past. A lot of those ideas predicted, rather than a relatively light Higgs boson, as has been discovered, a relatively heavy particle. And there were problems with the precision electroweak data. Nowadays, a much more favored approach is to postulate that the Higgs is some sort of pseudo-Nambu-Goldstone boson perhaps some sort of scaled up version of the pion QCD. So how would you test this possibility? Well, if you've got some new strong dynamics, you might expect that there will be some relatively strong modifications of the standard model predictions for the couplings of that particle. So one way of analyzing that possibility is to set up a general phenomenological parameterization of the possible Higgs couplings. And here I show you a framework which was adopted for doing that. So I introduce here in red various coefficients A, B, C, and so on. These are coefficients which parameterize the possible deviations from the standard model predictions. So A, C, etc. should be equal to 1 in the standard model, and you would expect that in some sort of weakly coupled Higgs model, such as, for example, supersymmetry, those coefficients would be very close to 1. But if you have some strongly interacting model, maybe there would be substantial deviations from the standard model predictions. So this is something that's been looked at by many different theoretical and experimental groups. Let me just show you a couple of examples. So this is a plot prepared by a group of experimentalists called GFITTER. So what they do here is, I have to apologize, my experimental colleagues changed the notation. So on the previous slide, I had A, B, C, and so on. But experimentalists prefer to call them kappas. Okay? So this is the parameterization of the coupling to vector bosons. This is the parameterization of the coupling to fermions. And the orange and yellow ellipses here, those represent the measurements of the Higgs couplings that I talked about earlier on. Now, they're independent constraints which come from the precision electroweak data. And these are actually somewhat complementary. As you can see, when you put in the precision electroweak data, then you get a much better constraint on the coupling of the Higgs boson to vector bosons. So this is another view of the ATLAS and CMS constraints on these couplings to vector bosons and to fermions. But what's been done here is to superpose the predictions of a couple of simple composite Higgs models. So this is actually minimal composite Higgs model 4 and minimal composite Higgs model 5. So they would, in general, predict deviations from the standard model prediction, but the data really like the standard model prediction, and so you have to tune your composite model so that it's that it reproduces the standard model predictions within 10% or so. So another approach which is favored more nowadays is to basically bite the bullet and say, okay, let's accept the fact that this is a standard model Higgs boson. And let's look instead for possible higher dimensional interactions, non-renormalizable interactions that would supplement the ones that are written on my pullover. Okay, so the interaction terms that I have written on the pullover, they have dimension 4, apart from the quadratic term which is hidden inside V of phi. But people say, well, maybe they're also higher dimensional interactions. Now, you couldn't possibly write those higher dimensional interactions on a T-shirt. There are literally thousands of them. How many thousands depends on how many higher dimensions you're prepared to go to. I just go to dimension 6, and I make various simplifying assumptions, I still have something which would take a long while to knit. Anyway, you can now use the same combination of precision electroweak data, Higgs data, and other measurements, like, for example, triple gauge coupling measurements, to try to constrain these various parameters and see whether there's any evidence for any physics beyond the standard model, or at least constrain the new scale lambda at which that might appear. So this is an example from a paper that I wrote with Veronica Sands and Tivong Yu. So we put in Higgs production data, triple gauge coupling data, the black error bars here correspond to a global combination where we allowed all the operators to contribute simultaneously. If you just switch on one operator at a time, you get better constraints, and that's shown in these green error bars here. And this picture here shows a similar analysis by Falkowski and collaborators. And again, this plot shows the complementarity of different classes of measurement. So here, for example, the Higgs measurements give you the constraints shown in green. Triple gauge coupling measurements give you the constraints shown in orange. And if you combine them, you get the constraints shown in blue. So this search for new physics beyond the standard model is something that just doesn't only involve measuring the properties of the Higgs boson. It involves a whole program of complementary measurements. OK. Now I want to return to the issue raised by the measurement of the Higgs mass, which is the stability of the electroweak vacuum and the future of the universe. So the Higgs self-coupling lambda, like any other coupling, is renormalized. And in particular, it renormalizes itself. And that auto-renormalization tends to make the Higgs self-coupling increase as you go to higher scales Q. But that's not the dominant source of renormalization within the standard model. Within the standard model, you also got renormalization by the top quark, which is negative. So that tends to decrease the Higgs self-coupling as you go to higher energies. And in particular, it looks like it drives the Higgs self-coupling negative at some mass scale, which is estimated to be somewhere around 10 to the 11 GeV. Now, clearly, there's some uncertainty in this, but prima facie, it looks like the top quark is driving you towards negative Higgs self-couplings, in which case our vacuum is unstable. I guess I've got a picture of this on the next slide, but basically it's telling you that instead of the standard Mexican hat form of the potential, it looks like when you go to large field values, it goes down like that, and that means that you have a quantum instability. Now, you could stabilize that by postulating some sort of new physics. That new physics would have to come in at an energy scale below about 10 to the 11 GeV. Could be supersymmetry, could be something else. Unfortunately, of course, this argument doesn't tell you that that new physics is going to show up at an accessible energy, an energy accessible at a future collider. But to my mind, this is perhaps, you know, the one hint from run one of the LHC that there has to be some new physics out there somewhere. But how seriously should you take this? So this instability scale depends on the mass of the Higgs boson, which I've highlighted earlier on. It also depends on the mass of the top quark, and it depends on the strong coupling. And there are uncertainties in all of these. If you put in the best available world average measurements, then you find, as I mentioned earlier, this instability sets in around 10 to 11 GeV. But those world average measurements are not completely up to date. In particular, there are various measurements of the top quark mass which have been published subsequent to the calculation of this world average here. And well, one of them is a somewhat larger mass, a couple of them are somewhat lower masses. There's also an issue with the actual interpretation of the measurements that the experiments make. So I think there's a lot of people who are still waiting to see whether and how the situation settles down. But at the moment, at least, it looks like the measurements of the Higgs and top mass put you in this unstable regime. Here I have another more recent theoretical calculation of this stability-instability boundary. But again, you see that the available data, as currently interpreted, seem to push you into this unstable regime. Now, some people say, why worry about this? Because if you calculate the lifetime of this unstable vacuum, it's typically much longer than the age of the universe so far. But of course, it better be, because if it wasn't, then we wouldn't be here to discuss the issue, right? But people say, well, since it is much longer than the age of the universe, no, Trump will kill us a long time before the vacuum of the Higgs. But there's another problem which various people have pointed out. And I got some plots here taken from a paper by Hook et al., but many other people have discussed this issue with similar conclusions. The problem is that if you believe in standard cosmology, then early in the history of the universe, obviously it would have been much hotter, much denser, and you would have had much larger fluctuations in the Higgs field, which would have greatly enhanced the probability for this tipping over into the unstable configuration. So I won't go through the details of this, but the general conclusion is that the overwhelming fraction of the universe would have gone into this bottomless Higgs pit over here. Of course, again, you could say, well, we just happen to be lucky. We just happen to live in the little piece of the universe that didn't fall down into the bottomless pit. But that sort of doesn't seem to me terribly satisfactory. And I prefer to believe that there has to be some sort of new physics, supersymmetry, higher dimensional operators, non-minimal gravitational coupling, something to prevent this cosmological disaster from having occurred. Okay, so that was at least one measurement of one mention of cosmology. So, having quoted previously one icon of popular culture, let me now paraphrase another icon, namely James Bond. So I just make a slight modification here. And a slight modification over there. And I paraphrase the title of one of the James Bond movies, and I claim that the standard model is not enough. And in deference to James Bond, I give you 007 reasons for thinking that there has to be physics beyond the standard model. So one is the one I just mentioned, that empty space, the electroweak vacuum, is apparently unstable. And of course, there's dark matter. There's the origin of matter in the universe. The masses of neutrinos that I scarcely mentioned. The hierarchy problem, which I discussed previously. Cosmological inflation, which you should eventually explain using the tools of particle physics. And of course, quantum gravity. I mean, I could give a lot more reasons, but James Bond is only 007, so I stop there. So the good news is that many of these issues will be addressed by experiments at run two of the LHC. And I would argue that many of these issues are, if not solved, at least mitigated by postulating supersymmetry. Now, of course, there are alternative ideas for physics beyond the standard model. And this is a slide that I stole from Nathaniel Craig, which in particular represents various different theoretical ideas about how to deal with the hierarchy problem. Like, for example, ignore it, or just tune it. My own favorite is still supersymmetry, and my attitude towards it is summarized in this cartoon from the First World War. So these are a couple of guys stuck in a trench, being attacked, like Susie is being attacked. And one of them is saying to the other, if you know of a better hole, go to it. So if you know of a better hole than supersymmetry, make my day. So anyway, I still love Susie, and I write supersymmetry in the largest font that will fit on the slide. And I would even go so far as to argue that run one of the LHC has provided three additional reasons for loving supersymmetry. One is that it can stabilize the electroweak vacuum. Another is that it made a successful prediction of the Higgs mass. It predicted that it should weigh less than about 130 GeV. And it also predicted that the couplings would be within a few percent of the standard model values. And that's, of course, in addition to all the other classical arguments for supersymmetry, naturalness, ground unification, string, dark matter, and so on. Now, despite this overwhelming indirect evidence for supersymmetry, there still seem to be one or two skeptics out there. So this is somehow summarized in this picture here, where you've got these beautiful peaks, and you've got this beautiful light shining on them. And I defy anybody to tell whether this is dusk or dawn. So maybe supersymmetry will finally be abandoned after run two, or maybe finally we're actually going to find some direct evidence for it. Now, the problem, of course, is that there are many different theoretical models involving supersymmetry. And this is another picture that I stole from Nathaniel Craig. And I would summarize this picture by saying that there are no signposts in superspace. There are many different possible scenarios, and before saying that supersymmetry is not present, you have to at least explore these different scenarios. So, of course, the LHC experiments have been looking extensively for various different possible supersymmetric signatures with negative results. However, they've also been looking for other theories of physics beyond the standard model, and they haven't found them either. So supersymmetrists maybe should be disappointed, but I think the other guys should feel equally disappointed. So those of us who like supersymmetry, I think, should be asking ourselves, how should we continue the search for supersymmetry? Should we just be continuing the same type of search that we've been doing up until now, missing energy and so on? Or should we be looking for some sort of unexplored corner of parameter space that people haven't thought about enough? Or maybe there's some sort of novel signature which has been overlooked. So I want to discuss some of these possibilities in the next few minutes. So as one example, let me talk about something which we uncovered when we wrote a recent paper about supersymmetric SU5 gut model. So this panel here shows you the constraints on that model before taking into account the run to 13 TeV data. So this plane is the Luino versus Spork mass plane. Now, one of the subtleties in this SUSY search business is that often people give you very stringent limits, but under simplifying assumptions about the way in which the supersymmetric particles decay. And those assumptions are not always accurate. Anyway, taking into account the branching ratios. Here is what happens after including the 13 TV data. So it's clear that the lower limits on supersymmetric particle masses have increased. But they haven't yet increased by a big factor. Okay? The increase in the lower limits is at the level of 10, 20% or something like that. LHC run 2 has not yet provided substantially stronger limits. So that was the Guino, this is the Squark. One possibility that we uncovered when we were doing this analysis is highlighted here by this red circle. This is a region of parameter space in this model where the up and charm squawks are almost degenerate with the neutralino that provides the dark matter. So this is an example of a compressed spectrum. People considered various possibilities for the compressed spectrum, but not this particular possibility. So this is something which maybe should be thought about in more detail. So here's the spectrum for this particular model. Good news is that if we look at the best fit to this model, many of these strongly interacting particles would actually be accessible to future runs of the LHC. So wait and see. So this plot somehow reproduces the information. This is how the limits on squarks and Guinos looked before LHC run 2 and after. So there's not a qualitative difference. There's a quantitative difference, but it's not an enormous factor. And here again, shown in red, is the reach of LHC at 14 TV at high luminosity. So I mentioned also looking for some special signature of supersymmetry. And one of the things that people have realized is that in many simple models, like, for example, that SU5 gut model that I mentioned just a moment ago, you've got the lightest supersymmetric particle, which gives you the dark matter. But you've also got the next lightest supersymmetric particle, which in many of these scenarios is relatively long-lived. And this is an example which shows you how the lifetime of the next lightest supersymmetric particle could be even as long as, well, we cut it off here at 10 to the 3 seconds, because if you have a model with a longer lifetime than that, then it's actually going to give you problems with Big Bang nuclear synthesis. But the lifetime could be as long as 20 minutes. Okay, so that was an example of a model where supersymmetric particles could still be within reach at the LHC, and which predicts a couple of interesting novel signatures. Now let me discuss another model. So this is the minimal anomaly mediated supersymmetry breaking model. This is an example of a model with a relatively heavy spectrum. So there's various different candidates within the scenario for what the dark matter might actually be. Could be a Higgsino, could be a supersymmetric partner of W or Yno. It could be some sort of mixed thing. But whichever it is, as you can see from here, the typical supersymmetric mass scale is measured not in hundreds of GeV, not even in TeV, but actually in tens of TeV. So again, in another recent paper, we analyzed this particular model and a couple of different assumptions. On the left, assuming that the supersymmetric particle provides all the dark matter, and on the right, assuming that it only provides part of the dark matter, and there's maybe a second contribution to the dark matter. And this and the other plots, which I'm going to show you in a moment, are color-coded depending on whether that supersymmetric dark matter particle is a Yno, a Higgsino, or some sort of mixture. So depending on the scenario, the spectrum can look quite different. But a generic feature of all these models is, as I already mentioned, that the supersymmetric spectrum is quite heavy, measured, as I said, in the tens of dB. So here I show you Arduinos and Squarks going up to 10 dB or more. And here are the existing reach and the prospective reach of the LHC. So this actually looks pretty puny relative to the spectrum that you might have in this particular type of supersymmetric model. The dotted line here represents the reach of a possible future circular proton-proton collider with 100 TeV in the center of mass. And in this case, as you can see, physics reach is much greater, typically out to squark or gluino masses of the order of 10 TeV or more. So this is one particular model that might motivate you to put down a few tens of billions of dollars to build the next generation proton-proton collider. How about dark matter searches? So this is a composite plot showing the reaches of dark matter searches to date. The sort of range of dark matter scattering cross sections and masses that are indicated in fashionable supersymmetric models, and the possible reach of future high mass dark matter detection experiments. Also shown here is the neutrino floor, below which you're dominated by neutrino background. So what do these models that I just talked to you about predict for the dark matter scattering cross-section? So this is the SU5 model. In this case, there's a significant region of parameter space which can be explored with upcoming experiments. There's another region which may lie below the reach of those experiments, and indeed below the neutrino floor. And a similar conclusion holds here for this anomaly-mediated supersymmetry breaking model. In this case, the predictions look rather different depending on whether you think that all or only part of the dark matter is due to supersymmetry. But the general conclusion is the same. You could be lucky, but you might be unlucky. I don't have time to discuss it in great detail, but there's actually a fair amount of complementarity between these direct dark matter searches and LHC searches for dark matter. And these are just a couple of examples showing that complementarity. So over on the left here, we have an example where the direct dark matter search experiment looks more sensitive than the LHC. But on the right, we have an example where the LHC wins out over the direct dark matter search experiment. So both classes of experiment are clearly interesting. OK, so I've talked a lot about the LHC. So far, the LHC is somewhere around here. It's embarked on run two. It's got of the order of 30 inverse femtobarns recorded usable data. And the next release of data analyses will probably be in March at the Morion meeting. But what you see here is that there are plans to increase that amount of data by one and two orders of magnitude. So those of you who, like me, love supersymmetry, I would call upon you to be patient for a little bit longer. This is a nice plot taken from The Economist, which reminds us that it took 48 years for the Higgs boson to be discovered, giving time for Peter Higgs to evolve from this to this. Supersymmetry, of course, was postulated in the early 1970s, and so far we're less than 48 years after the postulation of supersymmetry. So let's be patient for at least a little bit longer. Okay, so in the last few minutes, I'd just like to say something about possible future colliders. So one class that's been discussed a lot is electron-positron colliders. And this chart shows you the various different proposals in a parameter space, which is center of mass energy on the horizontal axis and the collision rate, the luminosity, on the vertical axis. So this is the ILC project, which has been discussed a lot for a full couple of decades now. Relatively limited in energy, also relatively limited in luminosity. Then there are ideas, for example, in China and also at CERN, for circular E plus E minus colliders, which would have even more limited center of mass energy, but higher luminosity, hence perhaps better suited for doing precision measurements of the Higgs and Z and W physics. Alternatively, you might favor this CLIC project, which could extend to much higher center of mass energy. So I think it's kind of premature to decide whether you want any of these machines. But if you do want one of these machines, I think it's too early to say whether you want to reach the very high energies or whether you want to reach the very high luminosity at low energy. So I couldn't resist advertising a paper that we wrote last month where we looked at the capabilities of the CLIC high-energy E plus E minus collider for analyzing higher-dimensional additions to the standard model. And this is just telling you that such a machine would have a very high sensitivity up in the multi-TeV range to possible coefficients of these higher-dimensional operators. But it would have better sensitivity than a lower-energy machine. But at CERN, when we're thinking about circular E plus E minus machine, of course, what we're actually thinking of is a very large tunnel where you could house not just a large E plus E minus machine, but also eventually a high-energy circular proton-proton collider. And so the combination of the two would enable you to explore both directly and indirectly the mass range up to 10 TeV or so. Maybe I'll skip that. So let me just show a couple of plots related to such a 100 TeV circular E plus E minus proton-proton collider. So this is showing you Higgs production cross-sections of such a machine. So as you can see, the Higgs production cross-section goes up by orders of magnitude from the LHC down here to 100 TeV. And this is interesting not only because it will enable you to do more measurements with more precision, but also because it will enable you to do more measurements. For example, one of the key things that we would like to measure is a triple Higgs coupling. And this would be something which could be measured much more accurately at such a 100 TeV collider than any other machine. So one thing is to measure the Higgs. Another thing, of course, is to look for new physics. And I already discussed how the search for heavy squarks and gluonos at such a machine would be interesting. And as this plot reminds us, such a machine will be able to look at the squarks and gluonos measuring above 10 TeV. So that brings me to the end of what I wanted to say. The discovery of the Higgs boson was really a watershed in particle physics. It still remains to be seen whether it's the closing of a chapter or the opening of a chapter or both. Certainly there's a lot that we still want to learn about the Higgs boson. Many supersymmetrists have got a little bit discouraged. I would encourage you by saying that rumors of the death of supersymmetry are exaggerated. I still think it's the best framework for TEV scale physics. Some simple models are under experimental pressure, but other ones don't have so many problems with the LHC data so far. I would say that there are reasonable prospects for supersymmetry discovery either at LHC run 2 and or via direct dark matter detection, although of course no guarantees. And I would encourage people to await the full run 2 data before deciding where to spend their next few tens of millions of dollars. Thank you.
Let's start with Quentin from the Thai.
Okay. Is it possible that the composites, WZ, Quarks, and Higgs look quite like no energies, but reveal their compositeness some high energy TV scale?
Well, it's certainly possible that quarks, W's, and Z's might turn out to be composite. And of course, one of the first things that was done with the LHC was to look for evidence for the compositeness of quarks by looking for some sort of form factor in the production rate of quarks at high transverse energies. Nothing was seen. I'm not sure whether Run 2 data have been analyzed from that point of view, but certainly that's something which I expect will be analyzed.
So I know you've tried to put an optimistic face on supersymmetry, but I think it's a fair statement to say that the second line of that slide wouldn't have ever appeared even 10 years ago. So why are people saying, where are these rumors coming from? Or let me put it a different way, what is it that can we say about supersymmetry that is presently ruled out by the data?
So I think that people have somehow got themselves psyched up that supersymmetric particles would start appearing below the TEV scale. And I think there was one particular motivation for that, which was the hierarchy or naturalness problem that I alluded to. And it's certainly true that if supersymmetric particles are heavier, then there is more of a fine-tuning problem than if they're lighter. On the other hand, I would say supersymmetric particles anywhere but below the Grand Unification or Planck scale reduce the amount of fine-tuning compared to what you would have if there was no supersymmetry. So maybe people were overly optimistic. I think one other contributing factor in that possible over-optimism was D-2 that I mentioned briefly at the beginning, because that was something that could neatly be explained with supersymmetry and if supersymmetric particles appeared below the TEV scale. So I don't think that supersymmetric explanation is excluded yet, but certainly in simple models, it doesn't work out that way.
But is there some definite bound now on the mass of the lightest supersymmetric particle, or is that not even set yet?
I would say there is not a bound. Okay. So I think that the this hierarchy argument is, to my mind, a rather soft argument. Okay, because it depends on how much fine-tuning pain you're prepared to put up with. And different people have different pain thresholds. Okay. What I think it has the potential to be a harder limit is dark matter. And it's clearly true that if you push up the masses of supersymmetric particles, then the dark matter density tends to increase, other things being equal, you know, unless you go to some corner of parameter space. And a lot of supersymmetry phenomenologists, such as myself, are thinking again about these peculiar corners of parameter space, and I mentioned one of the examples in my talk. But I think that that has a potential to be a harder argument, but again, as I said, there are ways of evading it.
Doesn't the fact that supersymmetry particle models have a large number of free parameters, 123? It's a lot of free parameters.
Yeah, so as I said, there's many different supersymmetric models. And before giving up on supersymmetry, I think you should at least explore some decent fraction of those models. There's a guy at the back.
Now, if the Higgs turns out to be composite, does that do away with the vacuum instability, or how does it impact on the vacuum instability?
Oh yeah, that would totally negate the vacuum instability argument, because the vacuum instability sets in, as I said, at a scale around 10 to 11 GeV. And the compositeness, that would be 1 TeV, 10 TeV, or something like that. And beyond that, it would be a completely different ballgame.
You listed vacuum instability as an argument for new physics, but on the other hand, I think there are very convincing arguments that the sitter vacuum are always metastable, in principle, at least, or gravity, so in some sense, one may think maybe that's an indication that just under model, we already see the channel, how it will decay. So.
Well, maybe a string theorist could deal with that question more authoritatively than I could. But I think if you start off from superstring, then you believe that the vacuum energy is always positive semi-definite. So this will be a transition to an anti-de Sitter.
Oh, but in superstring, there are lots of ADS vacuum, which is that's exactly the argument. So all the Sitter vacuum in superstring, they will be metastable towards decay into supersymmetric ADS vacuum. So that's exactly the argument why seeing positive cosmological constant. That's indication that they will be metastable vacuum.
I would still prefer that we actually live in a stable vacuum. I'm a sort of simple-minded sort of a guy. And for me, the fact that we have a very small positive cosmological constant is a hint that we're actually possibly living in the lowest vacuum.
If you were worried about fine-tuning in the 70s and 80s, should you be even more worried now or less worried?
I think you should be more worried in the sense that the lower limits on supersymmetry or some other new physics tell you that you have to put up with a higher degree of fine-tuning pain than you might have hoped for back, for example, before LEP started.
Good. So we should be worried about fine-tuning.
I don't know whether you should be worried. You should be prepared to ratchet up your pain threshold.
Let me put it positively. The standard model seems to be fine-tuned, and that requires explanation. The particle physics that we observe seems to be fine-tuned, and that invites explanation.
Right. I certainly agree with that. And so a lot of the ideas that were proposed back in the 1980s for dealing with that fine-tuning problem, I think, require modification. Supersymmetry is not the only one.
Sure. You mentioned that one way you could rule out supersymmetry was if you predicted too much dark matter. I guess the mass of the lightest stable particle would too high. Did I understand that correctly? If so, then I wonder, one thing I've never understood, to what extent is the existence of such a stable particle built into supersymmetry itself, or to what extent does it depend on some extra symmetry, R symmetry, or something, which could be appealing but maybe is not a necessary feature of the model?
I would classify it as an accidental symmetry or the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model, which is shared also by many supersymmetric ground unified models. but it's not necessarily the case. And you can certainly write down interactions that break that R symmetry, and which would mean the lightest supersymmetric particle will be unstable. And that's a whole different ball game in supersymmetric phenomenology, which I barely touched. I think it could very well be that supersymmetric particles are within our reach, but we just haven't devised the appropriate search for R-violating supersymmetry that's going to find them.
I see. So even if the mass scale was driven up very high, it wouldn't necessarily rule out supersymmetry, but you'd have to give up the dark matter. You might have to give up that it could explain dark matter. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. As somebody who was one of the first to work on supersymmetric dark matter back in 1983, I think I'd be a little bit reluctant to give it up. But obviously, even old dogs have to learn new tricks at some point.
What if the Higgs was not discovered to decay to be before?
Oh. So when I said that Higgs into BB bar has not been unambiguously discovered, what I had in mind was looking for some bump in the BB bar invariant mass spectrum at the appropriate mass. That said, the consistency of the data, I would say, require the coupling to be there. It's something similar to the standard model level. And that's shown in this plot here. Okay. So this is a global bit. You really have to have that decay there. It might have a different strength from what it has in the standard model. But I think that the consistency with other data requires it to be there. There's no direct evidence. Well, no direct. There's not strong direct evidence.
Questions? Not the same question.